Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another extremely exciting guest today. He is a legend of Icelandic chess. He has been six-time champion of Iceland, two-time champion of two-time Nordic champion. He was in the top dozen players in the world in the 1980s, and perhaps most famously beat Viktor Korchnoi in the candidate cycle in 1988, and he's back to playing actively. He's joining us from London, actually, where he's part of the appeals committee of the Carlsen-Caruana match, which as we record, it is the rest day before the playoff. You guys will know the winner by the time you hear this. But in any event, it is my great honor to introduce my guest, Johan Hjortarson. So Johan, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to join your podcast.
So how's everything in London? We had this incredible drama yesterday, which people already have been talking about a lot, with Magnus Carlsen agreeing to a draw about nine moves from time control with what most consider to be an edge in his position. Sitting there on the appeals committee, to the extent that you're able to talk about what the mood in the room was like, what was your reaction?
Well, I think I was very surprised, like the rest of the audience. Everyone thought Black would play for a win without taking any risk, really, and he was way ahead on the clock also. So it was came as a big surprise, obviously.
And as you're on the appeals committee, could you let our listeners know a little bit what that's like? So you're basically there in case there's some sort of disagreement. Are you able to track the game with an engine and listen to commentary, or are you sort of sequestered?
No, we are just can stroll around freely and watch the game. So what the appeals committee does is, if there is a dispute and the arbiter has to make a ruling, and let's say in the most extreme case, forfeit a player or something, then that player can appeal to the appeals committee, and we will then review the decision of the arbiter.
Okay. And luckily, you guys have not been pressed into duty in the 12 games so far.
No, correct? Yeah.
And do you mind, I think you mentioned in an email to me, but who else is serving on the committee with you?
So the chairman is the Alexander Belyevsky, the famous Ukrainian grandmaster who was the four-time Soviet champion back in the old days, and Nigel Short, the legendary English grandmaster.
Yes, a strong committee.
Yes.
So you walk around and you follow the you follow the action and get to catch up, I'm sure, with some old friends. So what has been, aside from yesterday's drama, which again, we'll have plenty of time in intervening weeks and years, and I think we'll be able to put it in better context after the rapid playoff, but what's been your overall impression of the conditions of the match and the play of the match?
Well, in spite of all the draws, I mean, there have been many exciting games, and in particular, I mean, the first game was very promising, obviously. The world champion was completely winning, so we kind of people were expecting that this might be the match where the blood would be spattering all over the place, but that didn't happen. And then later on, like around the middle of the match, Caruana obviously had a very promising game. I mean, okay, this ending where the computers found this inhuman win, you can't blame him for not seeing that. But then I think it was the eighth game, he obviously had a very nice position. So the world champion has been struggling a bit and gives the impression of maybe being a bit nervous. Also in the games where he had the edge, he was a bit like an impatient, you know, would force things quickly, so they would pattern into a draw. So, but these are really tough matches. Obviously, the last one against Karjakin in New York was, there he was struggling as well. But as we know, he is just a fantastic defender, and probably his strategy for the second part of the match has to go into the playoffs and for the games with the shorter controls, where he's considered to be even having even more advantage over his the best players in the world than in the normal time control.
Yeah, it's interesting because in yesterday's game, of course, he kind of ended up with rapid conditions. I mean, especially as you mentioned, he had a time advantage on Fabiano Caruana, and a position that by no indications was worse. But I guess it seems like maybe he's pressing a little bit just due to the fact that he has so little room for error in this 12-game match, especially as it gets toward the later stage of the match, where tomorrow, I think, I'm guessing, he feels like if he gets a small edge in one of the first couple games, he can push a little bit more. But, I mean, it's interesting that he had the time edge, an even greater time edge than he would want yesterday, but just wasn't ready to push.
Yes, that's probably right. He was just had been set on just securing a draw with a minimum risk and oftentimes, and maybe somewhat lacking in self-control. I don't know. So he was maybe following a plan to draw this game. And yeah, you can understand that. And obviously in the last World Championship match, he won in the playoffs. So you know, he has a good experience with that as well. So that may be affecting his decision-making yesterday.
Okay. And in your years in the chess world, have you attended other World Championship matches?
Oh, yes. The first one, obviously, was the match of the century in 1972 when I was only 9 years old. I went to see one of the games at that time, and then later on, at least one of the Kasparov matches, also Kasparov-Kramnik in London, whenever that was. So yeah, I've seen it, and these were obviously longer matches. That this was when we were back in what 24 games, so it's different now. So less room for error, obviously.
I'm excited to announce that this week's episode of Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chessable. If you're a regular listener to Perpetual Chess, you've probably heard me and our esteemed guests extol the virtues of Chessable even when they were not our sponsors. Chessable uses learning science to help you improve your chess as efficiently as possible. It's a great way to remember more ideas faster, even for a middle-aged dad like me. What's more, they're an open platform where anyone can publish their courses. I'm talking to you, chess teachers and coaches. And they've paid out hundreds of thousands of dollars in commissions to their partner authors. They have big plans for 2019. So if you're a student, author, or coach, be sure to check out chessable.com. So do you feel, obviously, everyone's talking about people's nerves and there's the heightened tension. You know, you can see it in for example, Olympia Huracan on Twitter posted a picture of the photographers taking pictures of Magnus Carlsen, where there's like 10 photographers swarming basically around him in the first 5 minutes when they're allowed to take pictures like that. And that really gives me a sense of what it must be like. So what I'm wondering as someone who has so much experience attending world championship matches is, do you feel an increased tension in observing this match, or is it just standard for a match of this magnitude?
Well, I think the pressure has clearly been increasing as the match progresses with all these draws. And, you know, there is absolutely no room for error, as you pointed out earlier. So, like in the last game, so, which may affect the decision of Magnus. But obviously, these are always extremely tense affairs. And I remember even as a nine-year-old feeling the pressure and the tension in Reykjavik in 1972. So I think it's just something that goes with these events.
And were you already a chess player at that point?
Yes, I was quite interested in chess at the time. But I think obviously that interest increased after the match. And like my generation of chess players, we were basically spawn out of the 1972 match.
And you grew up in Reykjavik, correct?
I did, yes.
So how common, I mean, I went to one Reykjavik Open and I got the sense, and this was about 12 years ago, and I got the sense that chess was even then a much bigger part of the culture than in other cities I had visited. What was it like as a kid? Were there just chess tournaments everywhere? Was there, after, in the sort of shadow or subsequent to the match of the century, was how popular was chess in sort of everyday life?
Yeah, chess became very popular, should I say, in the late 50s in Iceland. This is because of the efforts of Friðrik Ólafsson, the first Icelandic grandmaster, who is still with us and in good health. He's 83 years old now. I mean, he sort of grew out of nothing. I mean, at the age of 23, he played in the Interzonal in Portoroz, Slovenia, and qualified to the candidates tournament. So that created enormous interest in chess that has kind of been the case to this day.
Yeah, Iceland famously has over time, I don't know if it's still number one in terms of the most grandmasters per capita, but it certainly has been there at that time. And I'm sure even now with Icelandic chess players not quite being at the peak of their powers, it's still an extremely strong chess country relative to its small population.
Yes, you can say that we are very good in everything if you take the per capita. But unfortunately, we have not had any real top players in the last kind of 20 decades after my generation retired from tournament chess. I left tournament professional chess over 20 years ago, and obviously that has not been good. And so I think you can safely say that there is somewhat less interest than it used to be 20 years and going back, unfortunately, because it's necessary to have top players to arouse the interest in chess in general and among the younger upcoming generation of chess players.
Yes, and for listeners, I forgot to mention in the introduction that Johan is now the general counsel of Decode Genetics. So I would like to talk about that in due time, about your decision to begin practicing law in lieu of pursuing chess as a profession. Although again, you're competing again right now. But first, let's talk a little bit more about the Icelandic chess scene. So, do you have a theory as to why there aren't players quite on the same level as when you were at your peak?
I think it has something to do with the fact that it is obviously very, very difficult to make a decent living as a professional chess player nowadays. There is just so much competition, and this changed, you know, I think with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and everything opened up, and then you had all these very strong chess players from Eastern Europe competing, and there's much more competition. So to select professional chess as a, as your career is obviously a big decision that is certainly not going to make you a wealthy person unless you are among the very top. So I think that has something to do with it. And it's obviously a bit difficult to be a professional chess player in Iceland because you can't just jump on the next train for an hour and a half to compete in a tournament. You always have to travel, and even though traveling has become cheaper in the last few years, it's still a bit of a disadvantage to live in Iceland.
Right, and another factor is the cost of living in Iceland is known to be high. So
yes,
the prizes are the same wherever you go, but the money doesn't take you as far when you bring it back home. So do you feel like there have been scholastic talents that could have risen to a higher level, but the practical considerations of pursuing chess at some point either held them back or turned them away?
Yes, I think so. I actually can't think of any specific instances of someone not pursuing a chess career who was clearly very, very talented, but I'm sure that is the case to a certain extent.
Okay, and when you yourself, I know that you have at least one child, because I'd like to send thanks to your son, Hjörtur Yngvi Johansson. I'm sure I mispronounced it, but I want to thank him for reaching out to you and to me and helping coordinate that interview. It's a great honor for me. So I know that you have a family. So was it a fraught decision for you when you decided to pursue a different career, or did it just feel like a natural chain of events?
Yes, I would think so. I had studied law, so I had a degree, so I could do something else. And now, and I was about almost 35 years old, and sort of it was at the time to take a decision, because you can't maybe pursue a legal career if you're too old. And I was getting a bit tired of the traveling. So I thought it was maybe a good moment. I was kind of happy. I quit on the top. I think I had the highest rating I had ever had. I also have seen, which is a bit sad, maybe professional chess players declining in strength as they get older and having nothing else to turn to. So it was not a difficult decision at the time.
Interesting. And I gather it's a decision you're happy with to this day.
Yes, I would say so. I was able to build a very interesting career and doing something new. And I mean, chess is a great hobby, even though you don't play as a professional. You clearly can play as an amateur, like I'm doing nowadays, and enjoying a lot.
Yes, and quite a strong amateur. In 2016, you won your country's national championship yet again.
Yes, obviously when I started playing again, my rating dropped, you know, like 100 points, which was to be expected, but it has been kind of okay. Yeah, I was really rusty in the beginning when I sort of didn't play regular tournament chess for almost, 15 years, and then I started again back in 2015, and it took a year to sort of get back on track, but succeeded eventually. And obviously, I'm not playing.
Right.
I'm not on the same level as when I was a professional. But I mean, everyone can enjoy chess in their own way. I mean, there are so many different ways. You can play, you can study, you do whatever.
So what did the first tournament back in 2015, what did it feel like when you sat down at the board?
Well, it was a bit depressing and difficult. This was the Icelandic championship, if I remember correctly, when I finished in the lower half of the players. And sometimes you feel like you have suffered some kind of brain damage or something. but No, I didn't stop, and actually I was able to win the Icelandic champion the following year. So, you know, I got quickly back on track.
And when you did play in that first event, how long had you been planning your comeback, and how much preparation had you done for it?
Well, it was kind of a coincidence that I started again, because it was around the European Team Championship, which was held in Iceland in 2016, if I remember correctly. And sort of the hosting country can have an extra team. And someone tossed out the idea that it would be fun if there would be like an old boys team. So we decided to form a team, myself and my three colleagues, Helgi Ólafsson, Marki Pétursson, Jónell Árnason, who formed the core of the Olympic team in the old days, and together with our legend, Friðrik Ólafsson. So we formed this team, and I knew this well in advance, and I started kind of studying again. And when that tournament was over, I just kind of said to myself, why don't you just continue? And so I did. So I've been playing like maybe four tournaments a year. I also made a deal with my boss at work that I could take some extra time off to play chess in lieu of a sabbatical. So then it's how it started.
Yeah, and I gather your kids are probably a little bit older. I mean, I know the son that emailed me is grown up at this point, so I'm guessing that helped a bit.
Yes, it did. My son is now already 31, and my daughter is 25, and both of them have moved out. So obviously, yeah, there is less sort of domestic responsibilities.
Yeah, that certainly helps. Okay, so I have as I mentioned before we were recording, we've got a few enthusiastic questions from supporters of the podcast. The first one is from a friend and supporter of the podcast, Chris Wainscott, who's also a chess reporter and was quite excited to hear that you would be doing an interview for Perpetual Chess. And so some of this we just touched on, but I'll just read his whole question. Chris asks, it's quite common in the chess world for people to stop playing a lot of chess once they get old enough to have real responsibilities such as a job, family, etc. Of course, quite a few then come back to the game down the road. However, it doesn't seem to be that common for a grandmaster to quit and return. Although you never completely stopped playing, you did certainly reduce your schedule to only a handful of games here and there. Then you came back on a more regular basis. So two questions from that. First, what changed to make you decide to begin playing chess regularly again? And secondly, what has changed in your approach as a player over the age of 50 as compared to the 25-year-old who once vanquished Korchnoi in a candidates match? In other words, how do you play, prepare, and study then as compared to now? Or now as compared to then?
Yeah, I think we touched on the first question. It was maybe a bit of a coincidence that I started again. And I guess maybe I had some more time on my hands. I had a job that was, and still have, that is very demanding. But it changed in a way when Decode, the company where I work at, was acquired by the big U.S. multinational Amgen, the biggest independent pharmaceutical company in the world, and maybe things became a little more predictable, and also my boss has been very accommodating in allowing some extra time, so that's kind of happened. I mean, well, I'm what, 55 years old now, and you have to start thinking about what you want to do in your old age, and chess is certainly a very good hobby and pastime and rewarding. So that's maybe, what I was thinking about. It would be nice to be able to play tournament chess in the future. And if you've been retired for a long time, you can't stay out of the game too long. And that's it. Yeah, regarding preparation, obviously, when I left professional chess, we already had the databases and the computers, but like the chess playing programs were already very weak at the time. So maybe what has changed now is that the information is more accessible. I mean, everyone is using the engines. I do that as well, and so preparation is different. And you know, the more information you have, it's even a harder work. So that is probably what has changed. And I would think that you would need somewhat different qualities to be a top player nowadays than, say, 20 years ago. I mean, obviously, it's more about being able to use the various IT tools effectively, database, chess programs and everything. Probably memory is also more important to be able to memorize long forced lines. So I think you need maybe different qualities, but I'm not very IT savvy, so I try to use these tools as everyone else does. So the preparation obviously, yes, has changed somewhat.
Do you think that those changes are good or bad for chess, or do you relatively neutral? What do you think?
Well, I think they are good for the most part. One thing being everyone nowadays has the same access to information, so everyone is equal. You may recall in the old days when the news would not travel as fast, obviously, the Soviet players with seconds and everything, they had an advantage. And you can also enjoy chess enormously using these tools. I mean, you discover a whole new world. For instance, one thing I noticed quickly is that most positions are much more tactical than you expect. There are because these engines see the tactics very clearly. So maybe the downside is perhaps that the chess theory has become so enormous and the top players make fewer mistakes. So the percentage of draws is higher maybe, like in these top tournaments and like in this match in London. Some people see that as a disadvantage with the computers and all. But everything this has its pros and cons, but obviously it's more interesting, I think, to analyze chess nowadays than it used to be.
And I can't help but ask, following up on that thought, do you think that the current format for the World Championship is a good one? Do you feel that it's a format that's working?
I'm not quite sure. I've been discussing this with people here in London, and one common opinion is that these matches may be a little bit too small. Obviously,
yeah,
it's too short. Sorry, it's. I mean, nowadays everything is faster than it used to be, and like maybe a 24 game match would be too long, but sort of 16 games would be some kind of middle ground that many have talked about. And you maybe the players could take somewhat more risk, and if you lose a game, then you're not completely out. Like for instance, in a match like this is tight. If you lose the 11th game or something, it's extremely difficult. This is why the players are so cautious. So maybe this is something that could be done.
Yeah, I think 16 games would be better. I understand when people say that 24 games in this day and age is just not feasible, but 12 games is so short. I mean, I really feel like once you get to the back half of the match, you can, as we were discussing earlier, you can really see Carlsen in particular with the rapid sort of in his sights. And it changes the psychology and the entertainment factor of the match. And, you know, Carlsen's job is to win the World Championship. But if we're putting this forth as a product that should entertain people, then I think we need to give some thought to how to make it more entertaining. And I don't know if you've probably heard this idea before. Vladimir Kramnik popped into the St. Louis chess broadcast yesterday with Jen Shahadi, Yasser Seirawan, and Maurice Ashley, and he was commenting on the game. And of course, he had a lot of interesting things to say. But one of them was he echoed the idea that that maybe the tiebreak should be played before the match is played, so that there's no tie after the 12th game. If you have a ticket to the 12th game and the match is close, you're going to see players fight to the end. What do you think of this suggestion?
Well, I must admit I have never heard it before, not given it a thought. I think it's certainly a very interesting idea, and maybe one other idea I was thinking about that would also be could be applicable to top chess tournaments, that you would not start with the initial position. Maybe you could select like 100 positions after two or three moves. So basically in every opening, so the players would have to just couldn't count on theory as much. So this is something I was thinking about. But obviously that should be tried out in tournament chess before. I'm not suggesting that would be something you would do for the next match, but I thought it was an interesting, it would be an interesting idea, because one of the things maybe that making this a bit boring, if you like, is if you see the same opening over and over again and the players trying to improve with very small nuances that are not likely to grant them a big success except in exceptional cases. I mean, this is one idea.
Yeah, and I think that there's tons of good ideas. I mean, my friend Greg Shahadi has a lot of sort of radical ideas relating to time control. But what I liked about Vladimir Kramnik's suggestion is that, to me, it's small enough that I could see it happening. I think there's a lot of room for large improvements and possibly drastic changes. But I think realistically, the way these things develop, it might be better to start with something small and see how it works. And I could see playing the tiebreak in advance might fall into that category, because then you still have a classical chess match. You still have the original starting position, but at least you don't have players, at least both players steering towards a playoff at a given point. But anyway, again, there's going to be so much time to dissect this match, and I only have you for a limited amount of time, so I want to talk more about your own experiences. So another question from a friend and supporter of the podcast, Brian Karen. This dovetails with what you were talking about with using computers and the adjustments you have had to make. So Brian asks, as a player who peaked right before computers became strong enough to change everything, what are your thoughts of these changes? Did it shorten the career of players from your generation who refused to adapt, for example, Karpov? Did early implementers of this technology, such as Kamsky and Kasparov, benefit more than is commonly acknowledged?
No, I don't think so. I don't think these tools made any radical changes to people's careers one way or the other. I think there were maybe other things that have gone against kind of older player. It's the fact that nowadays there are faster time controls and no rest days usually in tournaments, so quite often you will see the older player make mistakes around move 40 and things like that. So I think that is a much more important factor if you are looking for something that has been against the older generation. And I think many of them adapted really well to these advances in technology. See, like, for instance, Gelfand, who is not much younger than myself. He is always really, really well prepared. And Karpov, I think he just had won, done everything he wanted to do in chess and was interested in other things. This is why he's kind of withdrew from, hardcore tournament chess. So, yeah, and Kamsky, this was also, very interesting. When he came out of retirement and was able to build a very successful career again, and he is one of the biggest fighters around and likes long endings and stuff like that, and so he must be in good physical shape, I'm sure.
And for yourself, when you came back to chess, you mentioned that you're not particularly IT savvy, but you did you know, you've managed to make it work for you. What about in terms of actual training? So there's the opening preparation, but in terms of calculation work or game review, how much are you utilizing computers to the extent that you're doing that stuff these days? How much do you utilize computers?
Maybe not that much, apart from opening preparation and preparing against a certain opponent. I still like to do things the old way. I really like chess books, good chess books, which have, I think, grown better, obviously, nowadays. I mean, when everything's checked with computers. And so, for instance, sometimes when I order 20 chess books online, and I'm filling the house with chess books. My wife doesn't like that very much, so I sometimes have them. I hope she will not be listening to this
right.
shit to work, and I take one or two books in my gym bag home at the time, you know. But so I still like chess books, and I'm told, for instance, by my friends at New and Chess, who are this internet chess bookstore, that they are in general selling quite well, which I'm very, very pleased to hear. So I still like to touch the pieces,
yeah,
and not only look at a computer screen every now and then.
Yeah,
as you know, there's so much information, that things that, you know, go quickly by on a computer screen, you may not memorize them as well as if you're like studying an endgame position on a wooden board.
Yeah, and it just feels different. I mean, there's something, yeah, there's a sensory experience when you're using a board and a book that you don't get on a computer. Since you mentioned chess books, of course I have to go down the rabbit hole of asking your favorite books. I mean, it's such a broad topic, so it can be something that made an impression on you in recent years, or something that you consider sort of most seminal in your own development as a chess player.
Well, it is a really difficult question. There are so many good books, but I'm a bit old-fashioned. For maybe if I would mention one a favorite chess book from former times, that was the book on the candidates tournament in Bled, Zagreb in 1959, where Fredrik Olsson played, which I think was written by Gligoritz and someone else, that in German, actually. This is one of my favorite, and maybe in general, books on great tournaments. I like them a lot, and also game collections of famous players. Much more so than openings books, say. I think they are usually forgotten rather quickly.
Well, I'm glad that you didn't, all due respect to Zurich 1953, but we've had many, many guests mention it. So when you mentioned the candidates tournament, I'm glad that you went in a different direction.
This is actually the 1959.
Right, yeah.
No, the 1953 obviously was really a great book as well.
That was, no, I'm saying saying I'm glad that you mentioned something different, because
yes,
I know that that's a great book, but it's good to get different recommendations. We've had 1953 recommended many times. So speaking of games collections, are there any that come to mind as your ultimate favorites?
Well, I have to mention the book with the 50 attacking games of Fredrik Olsson, my old idol and friend, which he published, but has only been published in Icelandic, sort of attacking games. This, of course, was my favorite as I was growing up, and still is. I mean, Olsson was a very, very original attacking player, and for instance, his performance in 1958, when he was only 23 years old, when he was, better basically against all the strongest player, and he would have won the tournament if he hadn't lost some points to the players in the lower ranked players. So this is my favorite, and maybe I could also mention the collection book on Rubinstein, Akiba Rubinstein, who was really a favorite player of mine. I think it was written by Gmoch, if I'm not to pronounce that correctly, which made a huge impression on me.
Okay, great. These are original suggestions. So what is it about Rubinstein's style that appealed to you?
His technique was absolutely outstanding for his time, and also many innovations in the opening. And he was like a highly modern player, I would say. And I learned a lot from, particularly, I would say, in the endings. He was just a really displaying 21st century technique back in these old days.
Wow, that's a strong recommendation. So, and do you feel like a book like that, do you feel like it's geared for a particular level of player? Like, do you have to be candidate master level to appreciate it? Or can any player of any level benefit from it?
I think any player can do. And oftentimes with these, you know, old masters, they were maybe playing against weaker players, and you know, it's easy to spot many mistakes, but he was just so flawless in the execution of the end games, for instance, that I think just anyone can learn from him. And I if I remember correctly, I think Kramnik, maybe was it Kramnik who mentioned him specifically as one of his favorites.
Interesting. Strong recommendations then, listeners. So you guys might want to check that out. So, Johan, I have another question from a new supporter of the podcast, Daniel Gould. Daniel, I hope I said that right. And thank you for the support, Daniel. So Daniel says, "Hi, Mr. Kjartansson. I'm working on a blog series based on chess.com's perspective on the greatest games of all time. One reader pointed out a skepticism of this list because there was only one pre-war game. I assume it's the opera game, and the reader insists it was prearranged. All that to say, do you have any suggestions for the listeners on great games to study that were played a long time ago? I assume in the territory of pre-19th century, though I'm not 100% sure what pre-war means." Putting on the spot here.
Yeah, I think I would need more time to make an intelligent proposal in this regard. I'm afraid, but...
What about a favorite game generally, both from yourself or just generally? Do you have any that come to mind as most treasured?
Yeah, maybe some games of the match of the century, 1972. The long game that Bobby Fischer one in the Alekhine's defense, wasn't it the 13th game, if I remember correctly? This was just an amazing game that is still kind of an enigma for everybody. I mean, you can analyze it with computers, and still you will always discover something new. I mean, this was quite just amazing, and how, and the chess of Bobby Fischer, obviously, in his last years of competitive chess in the early 70s are just amazing, because he had such an overwhelming control over his contemporaries, and it's not going to be repeated, obviously.
Yeah, and in fact, checking that, it looks like it was game 13. And what about of your own games? Do you have a particular favorite?
Yes, I would say, as I have said before, it was the first game of the match against Kostno in the Open Ruy Lopez, where I was able almost to refute his favorite variation. That was a rare example of me with superior opening preparation to the opponent, because I would not say that openings were ever my strongest side, but that was a very memorable game, and obviously had big impact on the match, because it showed that him that I was a serious opponent, I guess.
And I apologize for my ignorance, but I don't know the details of that particular game. So did you have a novelty that you sprung on him, or did you just sort of know the position better, or could you tell us a little bit more?
It was really a novelty when I played before. Actually, it had been played in one game before between, I think it was Balashov and Portis, which was a quick draw, and nobody paid any particular attention to that game. So in that position, all the moves were much, much more common. When you look at it at the hindsight, I mean, there is just no really good continuation for black. So, and then I was able to get a very strong attack quickly. And so I almost won this game with pure preparation. So, and it had this impact on the chess theory, that is, this favorite variation of his to play bishop e7, queen d7, rook d8 very quickly. It kind of disappeared from tournament practice.
That's quite an impact. And did the legendary GM have any sort of reaction after either that game or, of course, when you ultimately won the match?
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the stories. He was really using all the tricks from the from the Soviet chess manual to distract me, and so to the extent that we even had to lodge a complaint against this kind of behavior. This was when you could still smoke during chess tournaments, so he was blowing smoke into my face and trying to kind of disturb me, stand in front of the board and move rapidly and trample on the loose states so it would vibrate. And so he would use every trick in the book, and he was actually really, really annoyed after the match. He's not one to he's a rather bad loser, and that even grew worse as he got older. And you know, you must have heard there are many stories of him.
Yes, of course. Yeah, and had you trained like Botvinnik with people blowing smoke in your face?
I didn't do that, but actually I had good training from my junior years, because in the all chess clubs everywhere in the world, I guess, you know, the players, the smokers were smoking excessively. So that actually didn't bother me much, but it bothered me much more the way he was trying to distract me during the games. So
can you think of either something else that GM Korchnoi was doing, or you mentioned the Soviet manual, quote unquote, of sort of dirty tricks. So what are some other examples of tricks that would be pulled?
I don't know. It's somehow trying to disturb the opponent somehow during the games, and obviously in matches, you may recall the Karpov Korchnoi matches, and they were using all sorts of psychological warfare. Many the stories from the 1978 match between Korchnoi and Karpov in the Philippines obviously comes to mind. So these were the days, and perhaps also you know, when you were playing with fixed time controls, then there was much more room for all sorts of bad behavior, I suppose. I would say that nowadays, I think chess players are behaving much better than they used to do. And probably the increment has also maybe diminished possibilities for disagreement. And I guess also reputation is more important now than with all these competitions. I mean, players who get a bad name for bad behavior, they don't get invited to tournaments or sort of, so.
Yeah, and there's cameras everywhere.
Yeah, cameras. So these things have definitely changed for the better. And in my own recent experience, I can hardly think of any instance where I had the feeling that my opponent was trying to disturb me or annoy me on purpose.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that things have moved in the right direction. So tell us more about this famous match with Korchnoi. So you mentioned that, I mean, we know the result. We know it's a crowning achievement for your career, as it would be for basically anyone's chess career. Going into the match, how did you feel about your own chances?
Well, I was kind of optimistic. I thought I had a chance. I had actually beaten Victor the year before in Reykjavik 1987, where I was worse from the opening, but kind of defended well and tricked him in the time trouble. So I already knew at that point that I could beat him. I had done that once before. So I was not that, yeah, I was rather optimistic. And then obviously the match started very well for me. I won the first game, and then also the fourth game, where I had almost a lost position but was able to trick him in the time trouble. But then came the disaster. I lost game 5 and 6, so the match was tied after 6 games, and then we had to play 2 additional games. So in the 7th game I was wide, and I took the advice of, I think I've heard from Kasper or others, that if you suffer a heavy defeat, it's a good strategy just to make a draw, just to sort of to regain your self-confidence. So I did. It was actually, I was pressing him quite a bit in the 7th game. And then came the 8th and the last game, where sort of he made a blunder in the middle game, and also was very short of time, and eventually lost on time in a lost position before the time control.
Just incredible. And we talked about nerves in the World Championship match. Was that the most nervous you've ever been? I mean, I'd also of course like to talk about your subsequent candidates match with Karpov, but was that general time period the most pressure you felt as a chess professional?
Yeah, it's interesting to play a match. It's a completely different experience from playing a regular tournament chess, even though you have stressful moments there. I mean, it's a different kind of preparation. And obviously also playing against Kostnoy is, I think, always a stressful affair, because he just, you know, he is out there to kill you by any means, you know.
Right.
Like, for instance, you may recall the book published a few years ago by Averbach, this very interesting book where he kind of categorized players into like 5 categories, and one category was killers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he put Kortsnoy and Fischer in these categories. And then there were other like, what would they call them, explorers or artists. I don't remember, for instance, Boris Spassky. I think he was an artist.
Sounds right.
In Averbach's definition, it was quite interesting categorization of chess players.
Yeah, that is interesting. And he was definitely had the reputation of a street fighter, for sure. So moving forward on the timeline, once you did win this match, then, and just to give listeners some perspective, it looks like Kortsnoy was about number 5 in the world at 2640 around this time, and you were 2590, about 25th in the world, which obviously you guys are all elite players, so of course you had a chance. But I mean you proved you had a chance, but still, what would be perceived as a sort of wide gap in terms of ranking. And then the gap gets even wider, because 80 ELO points higher sits Anatoly Karpov. So what were your thoughts coming into that match?
Well, I must admit I was more pessimistic than before the match against Kostnoy. And I really didn't stand much chance in that match. I lost the second game, and kind of my opening preparation didn't work out as well against Kostnoy. He had obviously this enormous experience in his matches with Kasparov, so it was unfortunately a bit of a one-sided affair. I don't know. I didn't feel as good as against Kostnoy, maybe less self-confidence or something. So I didn't stand a much chance in that match, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I guess you would have run into him sooner or later, but it might have been nice if you didn't have to play him in the quarterfinals.
Yes, it was a quarterfinals.
Yeah, so it would have been nice to dodge him a little bit and move a little bit deeper. But sooner or later, he would have been standing there. And what was his... I mean, I guess it's different circumstances since he took control of the match early, as you say. But what was his disposition like? And were there any tricks involved in that match?
Oh no. I actually played against Karpov many times in tournament as well. And I mean, he is perfectly... correct at the chessboard. No complaints there. And Korsnoy, obviously, most of the time it was, quite okay. It's just, when we had his back against the wall, like in some of these matches, he would use all the tricks. But, I mean, Karp was completely correct player and a person. And I got to know him quite well, and we are even on good terms and greet each other warmly whenever we meet. So that was just a very pleasurable experience for the most part to get to know him and play against him. For the most part, I mean that obviously he would win like every other game or something.
Yeah, understandably. And did you get to... I mean, I'm sure you have at some point, but did you, during the course of the candidates match, did you guys ever do post-mortems?
Not against Korsnoy. No, I don't think so. I think it's less customary in matches than you are.
Okay.
You want to go back to prepare for the next game.
And did you have people helping you for these matches?
Oh, yes. I had my colleague, Marki Peterson. He was my main second for the... during both of these matches, and also for the match against Korsnoy, the impact of Fredrik Olarsson was really very important. He came with me to Canada as a head of the delegation, and he helped me kind of deal with Korsnoy, and Korsnoy, for some reason, I think blamed Olarsson for his loss in the match. It's kind of strange. Yeah, I never really felt any personal animosity towards myself, but they had also a long history, because you may recall that Fredrik Olarsson was the president of FIDE, the International Chess Federation, between the years of 78 and 82, and some people say the last gentleman of FIDE. Well, I think we have a gentleman as a FIDE president finally again now in Mr. Dworkiewicz. But when Fredrik was the FIDE president, he postponed the match which took place in Meran 1981 between Karpov and Korsnoy, because Korsnoy didn't get his family out of the Soviet Union, so until that matter was resolved. But he didn't pay Fredrik much thanks for that help, and Fredrik, the Russians, the Soviets turned away against him after this event, so he was not re-elected in 82 when Florencio Campomanes was elected the FIDE president, and we know that was the start of a rather, I think, bad era for the International Chess Federation, which yes, has now finally come to an end.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're optimistic about Mr. Dvorkovich's, I don't know how to say it, but that you feel that he'll do a good job.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, he is not clearly not in chess to enrich himself like some others have.
Yeah,
done in the past, and he has a very good track record in everything he has done, and for instance, he was the chairman of the organizing committee for the World Soccer Cup last summer in Russia, which was deemed as a great success. So I'm quite optimistic, because chess really needs a better name for itself, and that is, I mean, the International Chess Federation, to attract sponsorship for real sponsors.
Yeah, and the interest is there. I mean, the viewership numbers for this World Championship match, it's from my perspective, has seemed great. So I think with better leadership, the sky's the limit.
Yes, absolutely. And we know what happened with the last FIDE president, who was put on the sanctions list. It's maybe a display of the problems that were around chess at the time.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so Mr. Hartsersen, just one more topic, if you don't mind. So you... Obviously, being a lifelong resident of Iceland, I'm guessing you came across Bobby Fischer at some points in his later years?
Oh, yes, I did. I think I met him on three occasions, and I have to admit that was a rather sad affair. Obviously, he was my idol for many, many years, and sometimes it's, you know, difficult when you meet your... Yeah. Idol finally, and obviously he was in extremely poor mental health, and you really couldn't have a normal conversation with him but for a few minutes, because he would always lace into this anti-Semitic ranting, which was really disturbing to listen to, and this conspiracy theory. So I took the conscious decision at some point that I did not want to seek his company. I would rather keep him in my memory for the great chess he played. But it was really sad to see the state in which he was.
Yeah, well, not surprising in the least, but nonetheless, as you say, sad to hear.
Yeah.
So, yeah, can never meet your heroes, as they say.
No, yeah. I guess so.
Okay, well, I think that I have covered everything in my outline, although obviously I'm so honored to get your perspective. Do you, just one last thing, if you have any stories that you feel just the chess world needs to hear from your time on the road, whether it be brushes with some of the people we've mentioned, or, you know, legendary plays that we haven't, like Taman or Kasparov or anyone along those lines, it could be from a game or just, you know, from time away from the board. Do you have any favorite chess stories?
Okay, I'll tell you one story.
Oh, great.
About I was playing in the World Cup in 1989 in Barcelona, and I would dine with my great colleagues every evening, and one evening I sat with Boris Spassky and Lajos Portis. And, you know, Spassky has a tremendously good sense of humor and mm-hmm. always telling jokes, and really is not very serious, whereas Lajos is more of a serious person and thinking extremely well about his health and exercise and all that. And this is 89, and a few years earlier, I think in 1986, we had, you remember this disaster in the Ukraine, where the Chernobyl mm-hmm. power plant yeah. blew up. And so I'm sitting with this Spassky and Portis, and Portis is eating mushrooms. And then Boris said to him, "Lajos, you know they are still radioactive." "What do you mean?" "Well, mushrooms, they store radioactivity for years." And Portis obviously believed this and became completely red, because thinking he was eating radioactive mushrooms. So this was a typical Boris Spassky. So,
and he was just making it up.
Of course, he was making it up. But you know, to watch Lajos turn completely red was kind of funny. I thought I would tell you this silly story, which has not much to do with chess.
No, that's great. And Boris Spassky, I think, There's a lot of people I would love to have as a guest on the show. I've been lucky to have some incredible guests, but I think he could be the best guest of all because Melek Kachin told an amazing story about drinking with Boris Spassky, and GM Michael Rode told a story about him showing up for the New York Open in his tennis clothes and making a quick draw in order to go play tennis. So it just sounds like he had a perspective on life that I think our listeners would like to hear. So yeah. You know, your son set up this interview, so if anyone close to Boris wants to put him in touch, I would be eternally grateful.
Yeah, I mean, he was a great personality who will leave a lasting mark on everyone who meets him, obviously.
Yeah, and it's always rumored that he's writing memoirs. Do you have any inside information on this topic?
No, I'm afraid not. I actually met him in Berlin a few years back, and this was after I had suffered a stroke or something, and people were telling me that he was in bad health, but he was, when I met him, he was actually seemed to be in much better shape than I had expected, so I'm sure he is up to writing his memoirs.
Oh, that would be incredible. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Yeah. Well, Johan, I just want to thank you again. I don't know. I always ask guests if they're open to being contacted by anyone listening, but if you would prefer to keep your information private, that's perfectly understandable as well.
Yeah, okay. We'll see about that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Enjoy the playoff tomorrow. I mean, it's chess history before your eyes, so should be incredible to watch.
Yeah, certainly. It's for me, it's both exciting and a bit stressful at the same time.
Yeah, well, because of your role on the appeals committee.
Yes.
And do you have a rooting interest? You wouldn't be able to say even if you did. So we'll scratch that question and just let you go on and enjoy London before the big day tomorrow. So again, thank you so much. This has been quite a privilege.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my esteemed producer, Matthew Passy, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music, and everyone who's put in a good word for the show, whether it be on a podcast platform like Apple Podcasts or telling a friend or anything like that. As you guys know, I spend a lot of time on the show, probably about 5 hours a week between the research and the booking guests and the social media and the actual interview. I love doing it, but it can be hard to find the time. Which brings me to the financial support. I want to give special thanks to those who contribute to the show. Extra special thanks to Chessable.com for their generous support. And I also want to thank, as always, my Patreon and PayPal Perpetual partners. You are Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Ali Morchetti, Andres Quizdwa, Brian Mullis, Carl Labons, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Bill Moran, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Shabri, Chris Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach Jay's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel D. Schaefer, Daniel Vine, David Cramley, CEO of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Alec Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, I am Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Augard of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jennifer Valens of OffTheRook.com, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Hartman, John Jernigan, WGM Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Johnny McMenamin, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Leah Delgado, Lorraine Dore, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Macaulay Peterson, Martin Habish, Matthew Tedesco, Nate Salin, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Swaney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Ryan Sohn, Steiner Lima, Stuart Katz, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tchenko, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancourge, Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, everyone. Catch you guys next week.
Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.